Today's Teisho will be on case 20 from the Haikigan Roku, the Pienlu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 20 is entitled Ryūge as Suibi and Rinzai. Engo's introduction, range upon range of mountain peaks, rock faces and cliffs all deliver their profound sermons. If you stop to think, you will be bewildered. Let a person of great strength appear, overturn the great sea, kick over Mount Suvaru, shout and disperse the white clouds, break up the empty sky, and with each key and every kyo, shut the mouths of all other men. Such a person will be truly incomparable. Has ever a person been so wonderful? See the following. Main subject. Ryūge asked Suibi, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west? Suibi said, pass me the chin rest. Ryūge passed the board to Suibi, who took it and hit Ryūge with it. You knew that was coming. Right? Ryūge said, if you strike me, I will let you. But after all, there is no meaning in Bodhidharma's coming from the west. Ryūge asked Rinzai, too, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west? Rinzai said, pass me the cushion. Ryūge passed the cushion to Rinzai, who took it and hit Ryūge with it. Ryūge said, if you strike me, I will let you. But after all, there is no meaning in Bodhidharma's coming from the west. Secho's verse, Dragon Mountain, the dragon has no eye. Still waters don't impart the ancient way. If the board and cushion don't benefit you, hand them over to me. I have not exhausted this, hence another verse. Even if they are given to me, it's useless. Not for me to sit like the patriarch, beautiful, the evening clouds, endless, the distant hills, blue upon blue, peak upon peak. This is the final day of our January 2008 session. And I must say, it's been quite a success. I couldn't ask for a more perfect session. They're all perfect, I know. But things have just, I love the way it's worked out. Everybody's practicing really deeply, and that's just thrilling to me. I want you to know that I work as an English teacher at a university, and that's how I support myself, and it's an honorable profession, even though as the director of the writing program I am probably hated by hundreds if not thousands of students sometimes. Nevertheless, I have to do it. Nevertheless, it's an honorable profession. My passion, my real life is on the cushion, and my real joy in life is being here, being at Sesshin. I love Sesshin. I love this life. I love life when I'm not at Sesshin too. I love my job. I do. I love my job. I love the people I work with. I love my students, even if they don't always reciprocate. But there's something special about Sesshin for me. This is like my path in life. I just love Sesshin, and I'm very, very interested in all of you and your practice. know, this is like major concern for me. It's like the major concern for me. So I am quite sincerely interested in your waking up. And even though it's true that if you decide not, you should know that if you decide this is not what you want to do, you will never hurt my feelings. Even if you practice for 20 years, if you come to me and say, well, 20 years was enough for me, I'm not going to be angry or hurt. I won't, you know, that won't be my response. Nevertheless, I do care very much about each of you, and I'm very concerned or very eager to help in your waking up. So, you know, when I go to bed at night, I sit in bed and I think, what can I do? How could I help this person work through his koan or her koan, you know? And it's very pleasant there, you know, under those circumstances, to work with people who are so committed, you know, and they come into the Dokusan room, and even if they don't have something to present, you know, because they're struggling with various kinds of obstacles, I see them struggling, and that's just wonderful. It's absolutely thrilling, you know, to me. And so I want to thank you for your excellent effort at this session. And, you know, I want to tell you that it's very important not to have any expectations when you come to session, and it's very important not to form any judgments when you leave session. That is about your performance. You know, people have. We live in a culture where people are graded, assessed, and so on all the time. It's not an incidental. You know, it's not like this thing that's not that important. Everybody sort of pretends it is, but it's terrifically important. You know, the culture, from the time you're a little kid, you're sorted out into groups and you're told to compete with other people. This is true, you know. Even until it was outlawed in some states, kids used to be given intelligence tests, and they were segregated in groups according to their IQs. Now, when I went to school, this was actually the case. You know, so basically, by the time you were like in the first or second grade, the educational system had already made a decision about where you were going to wind up and what kind of education you were going to get. And I went through a school system like that pretty much the whole way, where I was basically lucky enough to be in a group that was headed for college. And so we were given like a good education, and then there were people who weren't headed for college, and they were given an inferior education in some ways. So, you know, this was, you know, and of course many of the people who were on the fast track for success didn't accomplish much. And many of the people who were on the vocational track did get to college and have been very successful and are very intelligent people, you know. So the system, you know, basically sorted us out, and there were penalties for not being at the top. And even in preschool, I have my sister has little kids, and she's trying to find a, you know, preschool for her kids. And even preschool is highly competitive now. It's almost insane. You know, when we went to preschool, it was called kindergarten, you know, we would just sit and paste things. We had a big jar of glue and popsicle sticks, right? And you could eat the glue. It was great, you know. It was peppermint, flour, and water, right? And I think it came in a powder. It was just powder and the teacher added water, and then we would just cut out little pictures and paste them onto these things, and we could eat the glue, and you know, and then we had to take a nap. We had to spread our little blankets out, and the teacher would go, "Now it's nap time, and I want to see your fingers curled up, you know, make sure you're relaxed." And it was great, but I think it's our culture is getting increasingly competitive, and people get a message early on that you've got to get in there and fight for testing has its purposes, right? I mean, grading has a purpose, but you know, this system goes from preschool all the way up to the PhD, you know, and people are constantly graded and categorized, and of course the whole system works that way, not just in school, but you know, you have people who have, you know, billions of dollars and people who can barely pay their rent, you know, and so the whole thing is a big pyramid, you know. And so it's very, you know, if you come to Zen and you think in terms of you know, this is like testing, this is the educational testing service for meditation practice, you know, you're going to be very unhappy, you know, because you're going to have a very false view of the universe, you know, and so, you know, the ideal sesshin looks something like this. I came to sesshin, you know, I had grade sits, and I passed my koan. You know, and I went home, and the teacher says, "Congratulations, you've passed your koan." You know, and it's like another. Anybody in the Boy Scouts, you know, or Girl Scouts, I actually was a failure as a Boy Scout, but I was briefly in the Boy Scouts, and my brother, however, was in the Boy Scouts, and he was like an Eagle Scout, and he had a merit badge. They had a sash, you know, that they wore. It was a piece of cloth that went over your shoulder, and it wrapped around your. It was like a circle of cloth, and you would do things that, and you would do like a. If you picked up all the newspapers in the neighborhood and took them to a charity, you know, so they could sell the scrap paper, you could get a community service merit badge, or if you went on 6 campouts, you could get a camping merit badge, and the camping merit badge had a little picture of some logs burning, you know. It was cute, right? And, you know, if you studied birds, you got a bird merit badge, and so on. So, you know, you rose up in the hierarchy by getting more and more merit badges. So there were some kids who really took this seriously, and, you know, I was in the Scouts briefly, and it just didn't fit my personality type, I'm afraid. So I was like a second-class scout until I was drummed out of the Boy Scouts. But my brother got to be an Eagle Scout, and he was constantly engaged in these projects where he would get another badge. And these guys in the troop, they were like the big shots in the troop, and they all would come in there with their sashes, and they just had like, they were like littered with all of these rows of badges, you know. And basically, it's possible to treat Zen that way if you want to. And you will meet people who are very far from understanding this path, who will, you know, maybe from other communities, other Buddhist communities, and they'll say, you know, "I've answered 50 koans," you know, and this sort of thing. And that's just preposterous, you know, it's totally preposterous. This is not a competition. People are not being graded and sorted, and it's not a testing system, right? It's not a testing system. None of those things are true. So please, it's very hard to overcome this way of looking at things. I myself had a great many struggles with this issue because I had trouble in school when I was in about the 10th grade. All of a sudden, my whole GPA just plunged, and I was failing algebra, and I was getting C's in English because my teacher wanted to diagram sentences. I don't know if you know what that is, but it's the most boring. There are few things in life that are more boring than diagramming sentences, right? And I could, it was like the algebra, right? How can you add letters? It doesn't make any sense, right? And we're diagramming sentences. And we take the sentences and put them on these little lines that had branches coming off of them. And it was like cutting up a sentence and putting it on the branches of a tree. It made no sense to me, right? You know. So I hated diagramming sentences. I didn't understand it. And I was doing very badly in English too, you know. And so I went through kind of a crisis. And my father told me, you know, you're going to dig ditches if you don't do better, you know, and this sort of thing. And I've had many moments in life where, you know, I became profoundly afraid of dropping into, you know, some terrible fate, you know. And so I really studied hard and tried to save myself and so on. Please, you know, so anyway, when I came to Zen practice, you know, I even though I loved sitting, and it was very liberating for me, it felt, in other words, it just felt good to sit, you know, I still brought all of these assumptions to the practice, you know, about competition and rising up in the organization, you know, and so on and so on. And this is what I'd been trained, you know, we live in a competitor culture, you know. So I had been trained to be a competitor, and that means be successful, you know, because you don't want to be a ditch digger, right? You know, this is the message. So you know, when I started doing Zen practice, I've talked about this before, but not everybody's, probably there might be somebody here who hasn't heard this story yet, so naturally I'll tell it again, you know. There was a you know, when Genki Roshi came to Seattle, it was in the 70s, the mid 70s, and Seattle was like a hotbed of hippie culture. You know, it was full of people who were in the quote unquote counterculture, and Buddhism was really big. In fact, you know, all these people, you'd see all of these Volkswagen buses driving around town, and they had a decal of the Buddha on the back. You know. So there'd be the Buddha decal. It was like almost like required. There'd be a rainbow decal and a Buddha decal, right? When Genki Roshi came to Seattle, all the health food stores, you know, all the hippie places were like a buzz, you know, because here was this guy who was this great Zen master. And so, you know, probably 30, 35 people started practicing with Genki Roshi, you know, soon after he arrived in the United States. And this was like the class of whatever this was, 77 or 76, something like this. And all of these people started coming to Sesshin. And we had like monster Sesshins for a while. Genki Roshi gave us all koans. And, you know, I was given the breath perception koan along with everybody else. And then, you know, I expected this was like learning algebra too. You know, I could do this, you know. And I was given the breath perception koan, and I just couldn't answer the koan, you know, for years. And all my classmates, so to speak, you know, all my classmates were going forward to the next grade, and I was like still in kindergarten, Zen kindergarten, you know. And this is how I thought of it, you know. So these people would, you know, apparently just go into Dokusan and do something and come out with a big smile on their face, you know. And, you know, it's very, very important that you don't talk about what happens in Dokusan with other people. It's between you and me and enlightened mind. Yeah. So it's very important not to. It's not something that is really for public consumption. You know. You should if you want to tell your wife or your husband, you know, pull the shades down, you know, turn on the radio, and then just say, listen, you know, okay? But unfortunately, people in our group were not responsible about this. And, you know, did you hear, you know, Sharon passed her koan, you know? And or people would say, oh, I passed another koan, you know? And I would be, you know, coming out of the doka, I mean, I would go into Dokusan. And some people would go into Dokusan, they'd be in there forever, right? They'd be in there, and then they'd come out with a big smile. You know? And I'd go in, I would just barely get out of, you know, traditionally in Zen, the teacher has a bell. So it's like when the teacher is done, the teacher doesn't go. In Zen tradition, generally speaking, the teacher doesn't go, is there anything else you'd like to tell me? That's not how it works. You go in, you have just like a few minutes before the hook. It's like the gong show, you know, the hook is going to come and pull you off the stage. So you got to come in, make your presentation, and the teacher is just like trying to move them through, you know. So it's like I would come in and about, bing. It was like that, I'm not kidding, you know. And then I'd go out and I think, and I would rationalize. I would think, well, maybe, you know, maybe this takes a long time, you know. But then, you know, I would see these people coming out, you know, with a big smile. And, oh yeah, I passed another go on. Oh my God, you know. And so it bothered me a lot that I was like the class clown, you know. In American education, when they don't do this anymore. It's against the law, I think. But in the old days, when you acted up or if you weren't doing well, they used to actually make you sit in a corner with a big conical hat on that said dunce. That used to actually happen in the United States. The dunce. And it was called a dunce cap. And the teacher would say, all right, Herbert, now you have to put on the dunce cap today. Really? This used to actually happen, you know? So I felt like I was the guy with the dunce cap on, you know? And I stuck with Zen because it helped me, you know, the meditation part helped me enormously, you know? It really made my life better. But there was this undercurrent, you know, where I just felt like everybody was doing better than I was, and why was this? And this can really hurt your practice, because it's not an accurate representation of what's happening. You know, it took me, I don't know how many years, I often say five, but I really don't remember. Probably I don't want to remember how long I worked with the breath perception koan, but I never really passed the breath perception koan. In fact, I don't know if you ever have dreams like this, but I'm sure you have I have a dream. You may have a dream where I get to school, and I realize I have to take an exam that I haven't studied for the material. I don't know if you ever have that dream, but I still have that dream sometimes. I also have a dream where I realize that I never actually finished college, you know, and then I'm a big phony, right? And I'm like, oh my God, I never actually finished college, you know? Oh my God. You know? Well, I don't know how I got on that. But these are all anxieties that I brought to Zen practice, right? And it ruined my practice in a certain way. It made it more difficult to appreciate the beauty of this path, which is not part of that cultural universe, you know? I mean, humans have created these hierarchies, these competitive systems, and it's all very unhealthy, really. It's you know, some people do things because they love them, you know? Like, I in high school, just wanted to get good grades after a while because my parents loved me if I got good grades. So I actually got like straight A's in the last 3 years of high school because I just wanted to be a good boy, you know, and I wanted to be successful and I didn't want to dig ditches. So I actually would just study all the time and I would get straight A's, you know. And I had very little interest or curiosity about what I was doing, you know. I just wanted to get the good grades and move on, you know. And, you know, when I got to college, I sort of went through a crisis because I got interested in, like, English literature, you know. And everybody I knew said, "Are you out of your mind?" You know, because you'll never get a job, you know. You'll dig ditches, you know. I realized this is something I really love. You know, it was like the first time I realized I really love poetry. You know, I love it. You know, and nobody in my family had ever read a poem, you know, really, you know. So it was hopeless. It was lost on them, you know. I'd come home and go, "Oh, listen to this," you know, including Chinese poetry. You know, I liked it, people like Li Bai. And I would, when I started reading translations of Chinese poetry, I was just like hysterical. I just thought, this is it, you know. I remember reading Han Shan in college. And just, and I would come home and just, you know, to my brother, "Listen to this," you know. It was just like, I could have been, you know, a Martian, you know. It was just totally, but there was something about this that spoke to me, right? And anyway, there's a different way to live, you know. This rat race, is sometimes we have to work in a rat race system, but we have to be careful not to turn our Zen practice into a rat race, because it's not about, the clock isn't running, and it's not about getting a good grade on a test. That's not what Zen practice is about. It's a different it's becoming a deeper human being, it's experiencing a deeper life, a bigger life. It's becoming a different kind of person, yeah, from that. And it's hard to work through this, you know, but you know, the greatest Zen master of the 20th century was a Chinese man named Xu Yun. And Xu Yun had parents who were government officials, and they were somewhat Buddhist, but they weren't really supporters. And Xu Yun, from an early age, wanted to be a monk. And his parents were horrified. They wanted him to be a government official and to rise up in the hierarchy, compete, you know, and so on. And they wanted him to get married and have lots of children, okay? In fact, they married him off when he was like 17. This was in all cultures until recently. In Europe too, this was done until like about 200 years ago. So they married him off to two young ladies just to make sure he didn't become a monk. And the plan was all set for him. Then his father died, and Xu Yun left his family, and he entered a monastery. By the way, his wives did the same thing. He had convinced them that this was a great way to live, and they became famous. One of them, anyway, became a famous master in her own right, you know. And they used to write letters to each other like 50 years later, and she was the head of a convent, you know. Xu Yun started meditating practice when he was about 19 or 20. And he didn't have his great awakening, his Dai Kensho, until he was in his 50s. Okay? So you know, if you will, again, you'll meet these people who will tell you, you know, there'll be some Japanese guy or some Indian guy or maybe some Chinese person will come and say, or Tibetan, you know, oh yes, I had my Dai Kensho at 25, you know. But don't listen to that. You know, that's totally meaningless, you know. You can have a Dai Kensho and still be a very undeveloped person because you haven't let it soak into your bones, your blood and your bones, you know. In the Zen tradition, people don't, people in American Zen is great in many ways, but you know, in a classical Chinese Zen, Chan, early people in the Chan world sort of had a little rule. You waited 10 years after your Dai Kensho before you would even think of teaching. And the idea is let it soak in for 10 years. Let it soak into your bones, you know. And then maybe you can help people. Now clean up, spend 10 years after Dai Kensho, clean up your karma, see. And let that enlightened mind just percolate into every fiber of your being, you know. See, Joshu didn't start really teaching until he was like ancient. He was like 90 or something, you know. And you know, the American goal, the American way of thinking, and it's really the modern way of thinking, would be like, you want to be like a star, like Zen star. So you're going to get in there, have enlightenment at 25, national prominence by 35, you know, big temple by 45, you know, and an international organization, right, by 50, right? And this is so wrong. This is like so wrong. It's so wrong. I shouldn't say wrong, maybe, but it's wrong-headed. It's so wrong-headed, you know. There's a wonderful book in Chinese tradition called The Lives of the Eminent Monks and Nuns. It's actually the lives of the eminent and something like eminent and accomplished monks and nuns. And it basically says something like, they're the eminent monks and nuns, and they aren't always very accomplished. And there are the accomplished monks and nuns, and mostly they aren't eminent. So they're kind of making a comment there, right? They're saying, what the world thinks is not necessarily reality. You know, the stars, that's a very shallow view. Xu Yun took 40 years to have Dai Kensho. And you're talking about a guy who did Sesshin all the time, right? I mean, like, his life was Sesshin. And Xu Yun, you know, when, you know, he was, this, you know, I believe every word he says, you know. He tells a little story about how he was living up in this hut, which is still in China. His hut up in the mountains is still there. And some monk lives there now, or some nun lives there now. But he was up there and he was making some rice, and he said, while my rice was cooking, I thought I would do some zazen. So I sat down. Next thing he said, oh, then I went into deep samadhi and I came out and I thought, how's the rice doing? But it was cold, you know. It had cooked and it had gotten cold, you know. And it was, you know, that's great, right? You know. So he's a guy who can do that kind of samadhi, right? And it's still, so, you know, this is, it's very important to realize that this is like, it's a little bit like the arts, you know. It takes a long time to mature as an artist, you know. It takes years and years, and it's about your whole relationship to the universe, you know. It's about your whole relationship to the world, people who have a deep spirit, you know, they don't just glide past their obstacles. They work through them. You know, they work through them. And that can take a long time. You know? It's often that you'll meet people who have been told, you know, you're a Roshi, blah, blah, blah. And you meet them and think, you know, they seem to be very full of themselves, you know, very egotistical. And indeed, that's probably not a false impression, you know? they have a shallow accomplishment. Whereas, you know, this is about, you know, I mean, when you're doing the mu koan, you know, you're in the mu is the gate to the Buddhas and the founders. You know, it's the most incredible thing in the world. You know, don't you want to jump in there deeply? Don't you want to throw yourself in there and become one with mu? You know, and so there's a kind of this. You know, there's a kind of being a little dissatisfied because you're just not totally one with mu is kind of a healthy thing, you know. I'm still dissatisfied with my own practice, you know. Really, I mean, I just can't wait to practice every day because I want to be a Buddha, you know, and I'm quite far from that goal. But I'm going to keep going, you know, no matter what. And I have many obstacles, and I have a lot of karmic baggage, like everybody else. But it's such a pleasure and such an honor to walk this path. So you know, it's not about time. It's not about getting merit badges. You know, a person who spends to tell you the truth, you know, I mean, I don't think it's false modesty. I think I'm a pretty good sitter. You know what I mean? I think my meditation practice is quite good. It wasn't for many, many, many years. And I think one of the reasons I am a pretty strong sitter, and that's just the truth, is that I had so many struggles to do this. You know, I struggled with my breath meditation for so long, and I couldn't get it right, and I struggled with my posture. You know, even today my posture isn't that great, you know, but it was so hard for me to get my legs down on the cushion. It was so hard to get into lotus posture. It was so painful, and this was true for my teacher too, Webb. He's a frighteningly good sitter. He can just sit until you want to scream, right? You know, I mean, he can just sit until you, one of the things he likes to do to you is, when Jara went out to visit him, and I don't think Glenn did this, and it's a lucky for her, because he'll say, oh, let's get up in the morning and sit together, you know? And then you'll get up at like 4:30, and then he'll just keep sitting just to see when you crack. It's like, oh, I've got to uncross my legs now. It's like, oh, okay, please, you know? So it's like, I'm sort of kidding, but he can sit for a long time, you know? And it's because, you know, I've talked about this, but Glenn, when he was practicing in Japan, when he first started out, in Japan you have to sit full lotus. You can't sit any other way, right? So if you're going to practice, it means full lotus. If you don't want to do full lotus, goodbye. You know? Yeah. So basically, there's the teacher's assistant, the jikiji, who goes around, and if you're not in full lotus, he's going to pull your legs in full lotus, whether they want to go or not, you know. So Glenn would be sitting there in full lotus he would just puke, right? I mean, that sounds terrible, but sometimes he would just be so agonized, he'd just throw up. And basically, you know, they'd say, here's your mop, here's your rag, here's your bucket, clean it up, and get up there and get back in full lotus. Terrible, right? But he is such a great sitter, and it didn't come easy for him. And so I think that builds character. I do. I think it builds, it makes you a deeper person, you know? When I started sitting in Seattle, there were these guys who would come in, and they would just pull their legs up into full lotus right away. And I was like unable to get into Burmese. My legs wouldn't go down on the mat. And then eventually I could do like a sort of a feeble little half lotus, you know? And there'd be these guys that'd come in, they'd breeze into the Zendo, and they'd pull those legs right up there. And I would just think, oh, damn, if only I could do that, you know? And this is actually the truth. I mean, I hope you won't think I'm crazy or something. But I learned to sit full lotus after practicing for about maybe 7 years. I went down to New Mexico for a month, and I stayed in the house of my sister-in-law. And every afternoon I would just sit down and pull my legs up, and I would just keep them up there for as long as I could stand it, you know. And I'm not recommending this, by the way. Don't do this. It's not a good idea. But I would just be, this sounds crazy, but I would just be rocking back and forth, like, I'd be rocking, oh, okay, what, 10 minutes, okay, you know. By the time I came, by that end of that summer, I could get through a sit in the full lotus position, you know. And it was so hard for me, but it meant so much to me, and I love sitting. It means so much to me, and I love it so much. I hope I'm making some sense, you know. I hope. In other words, you know, it was such a hard thing to achieve, you know, and so I appreciate it so much. And I think I have a good relationship to my practice. I know people in the Zen world who don't like to sit, you know. And I'm sorry that that's the case, because this is like the most wonderful thing. There's no time when I don't want to sit. I just love sitting. And there are people who finish their practice and it's like, well, I've done that. You know, I never want to go back to that. And it's like, what? You know? So anyway, please don't pass judgment on your performance. Please, find a way to love what you're doing. It's the most important thing is that you love Zen practice. And that's one of the reasons it's not a good idea to tie your legs up or something and rock back and forth. You know, it's very important to find a way to practice that feels natural to you and that feels liberating to you, you know. And then, you know, you just develop naturally. There's a natural development, uwe. You know, if you love this path, it'll deepen. And it doesn't, answering your koan is not the point. Enter deep mushin and feel the spaciousness, you know, the beautiful spaciousness of mu. And when you leave sesshin, you know, take a minute and just realize, I am so calm. I'm so happy. I feel so free. You know, if you can say some of those things, then the koan's just the means to the end. You know, I hope I'm making sense. You know, but this is really not about answering koans. It's about awakening. It's about becoming awakened beings. You know, there's a kind of poison, which is the poison of competitiveness and the striving mentality, which wants to see this as like acquiring merit badges or passing tests and getting a certified degree, you know. And this is, it could take you, just to terrify you, it could take you 50 years to answer the mu koan, right? But you know what? That's not at all a bad thing. It's not, you know. And somebody else could answer 100 koans in a year, but their practice might be quite inferior to yours, in the sense that you might have a deeper relationship to mushin. I can go on and on, but please. Please find a way to love your practice. This is the most important thing, you know. And if you love your practice, you know, you can put up with all kinds of bullshit, right? You know, your legs might not get in the right posture. It's taken me years to work out a posture, and my body keeps changing. And there have been times where I thought pain was behind me, you know? And then all of a sudden, you know, I start sitting on the cushion and I get this pain in my hip. I think, what is that all about, you know? So then you find a new way to sit. You add a little cushion back there, or you take the cushion away. I've sat on high cushions, low cushions, you know. It's, you know, but I just, even though there are these kind of challenges, there's something so liberating and beautiful about this path, you know. So, okay. So what does this have to do with the koan? Ryuge asks Suibi, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? Suibi says, pass me the board. You know, it's a chin rest. In China, people used to meditate all night. They'd sit in lotus posture and they'd meditate all night, and you say, well, how do they keep from falling over? You had a chin rest. So, yeah. They actually built a thing. You put your head, okay, it's like, good night, everybody. Good night. You go down to the ground, right? So it's problem solved, right? And they go to sleep during meditation, right? Okay. So anyway, there's a chin rest next to this roshi. He must have been using it, okay? So Ryuge came to Suibi and said, what's the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the West? And Suibi said, pass me the chin rest. And bam. Right? And then he goes to see Rinji. And Rinji says, please, pass me that pillow, will you? Wham. You know. It's not about koans, right? It's not about, koans are a means to an end. It's about deepening our relationship with the world. It's about being a fully alive person. A fully alive, deeply alive person. And that's not easy, not easy. Right? You know, this guy's coming in to see these great teachers. He's got some little question he's going to ask. And he thinks he has an answer. So you hit me if you want, but I'll tell you, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, and they just think, get out of here, you know. It's not about that. He doesn't get it even after they hit him with the pillow or they hit him with the chin rest. He still thinks, you know, it's about, he says, oh, I have another koan. You know, I've got another koan here, you know. It's bigger than koans, right? It's about becoming one with life itself. And that's a very there's no more challenging enterprise, right? But you know, if you have these moments, you know, sometimes on the cushion you have these moments where you just think, this is absolutely amazing.